with the last half of the book of Leviticus, page 2 of our notes, Conduct, Regulations in Israel, Leviticus 18 through 27. Incidentally, recently republished in a good commentary on Leviticus, which will be in our library, is by Wenham, W-E-N-H-A-M. He has a particularly good balance of dealing with the text and what it says, and at the same time showing its relevance for believers today. Many times in the commentaries, they don't make any application whatsoever and show how it is important for us to understand today. He has a good balance in that. This will be in the library as of tonight. Right? Okay. We'll try to emphasize these in connection with all of our studies because inevitably there's some little section that we go through that seems to excite certain ones and would like to work with it. I can think of lots of possibilities of what we did this morning. It'd be interesting if one of the ladies would pick up and get a little series together. Or why don't you get a doll and dress the high priest? Let the gals make the long tunic and the robe and so forth, and it's a good opportunity to keep kids' hands busy. For some of the kids to work the tabernacle. You don't have to get a big complex thing, but just work out the basics of the tabernacle and so forth would be a good thing for them to cover at home or in any other class opportunity. Lots of different ways to go on it. All right, we're looking at the conduct regulations in Israel. That's chapter 18 chapter 27. And in the first half, remember, the stress was on the basis of fellowship is sacrifice. Now, in 18 through 27, we're going to have a stress on the walk of fellowship. First of all, it was the basis of it. Now it's going to be a stress on the walk of fellowship. And under the idea of walk is the idea of conduct, the idea of behavior, and it's the walk of fellowship and not resting on the sacrifices like our fellowship with God does, but the walk of fellowship rests in this context on separation to God. A strong emphasis throughout this of don't do the things that the people that surround you do, but in contrast, here is what you're supposed to do as believing Israelites. The foundation for Israel's conduct, I think we can nail it down to Leviticus 19, verse 2. Leviticus 19:2 gives us the foundation for Israel's conduct, reading it. Speak to the congregation of the sons of Israel and say to them, you shall be holy, reason, because I, the Lord your God, am holy. Now notice I've blocked off as an important statement in our notes for today, blocked off with the plus signs, a very important concept. That is this. It is the prerogative of God to set forth the special conduct and character required of his people with whom he chooses to associate his holy name. In other words, he's simply saying to Israel, look, I am your God, and because I am your God and you use my name, then I have a right to expect a certain character and a certain conduct out of you. And I would take it that's exactly what he's saying in 19:2 and making that the foundation of all of the conduct of Israel. Or could we put it a different way? The conduct of the believer is based on who God is, not on who we are. Conduct for the believer is based on who God is, not on who we are. Now, is this principle that we've enunciated, that it's God's prerogative to say, look, if you use my name, then I expect a certain character out of you. Is that purely Old Testament, or is that also valid for the church age? Look at 1 Peter 1. And Peter, in expressing his concept of how they're to live the Christian life, goes right back to Leviticus for it and says, look, church age, same thing is true as in the Old Testament. You use the name, you act like the name. 1 Peter 1, 15 and 16. And notice his theology of the Christian life is derived from this statement in Exodus. 1 Peter 1, verse 15, which reads, But like the Holy One who called you, be holy yourselves also in all your behavior, because it is written, you shall be holy because I am holy. So notice, the character of God makes demands upon us. Now, the only way we could avoid that is if we had nothing to do with God. But the minute we look at God and say, I am a Christian, that's not my name, that's His name. And He says, look, if you're going to attach Christian to yourself, that's my name, then I have the prerogative to say there's certain things that I demand of you and that I expect of you. Now, let's go back to chapter 18 and notice how strongly that comes forth. Chapter 18. And verse 1. Now, to show you how strongly God is going to emphasize this point, that you must act a certain way because you're my people. Reading in chapter 18 and verse 2. Then Yahweh spoke to Moses, saying, speak to the sons of Israel and say to them, I am the Lord your God. Now, I, in my own text again, have taken those words, I am the Lord your God, and put an arrow out to the margin and made this note. This expression, Israel, I am your God, occurs about 50 times from here to the end of Leviticus. So we've got embedded throughout this a very strong thing, and it will be used in connection. Here's the way you ought to act, because I am your God. So this principle is extremely important, and it's why we took the time then to box off here the statement about the prerogative of God to require people who use His name to act like His name. And therefore, the basic reason for God's insistence on holiness in His people is found in the expression, quote, I am the Lord your God. Now, if that is the basic reason why God insists on holiness because of His name, then can you think of a way that you could violate the command that says, thou shalt not take the name of your Lord your God in vain or lightly? Any time that an Israelite's conduct didn't match up to God's name, what was he doing? He was using his name lightly. And this is what the latter part of Leviticus is going to say is displeasing to God. All right, that moves us in now to regulations concerning the people. Regulations for the people. 18 through 20. And they are going to have a unique way of beginning and the unique way of ending. How does this section of 18 through 20, three chapters, how do they begin? They both begin with a formal statement. Formal statement starts and ends this. The formal statement that begins it is 18:1 through 5. And the formal statement that ends it is 20:22 through 26. Now let's read both of those through, and I think you'll be able to get the thrust that in this little section that's talking about here are regulations of conduct for my people, he kind of parentheses it off by giving a nice little introduction, then he goes into the regulations, then as he comes to the end, he gets back to a formal style and closes it out with a rather formal type statement. Reading in chapter 18, the formal statement that begins it. This is sort of the prelude to the regulations. Then the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, speak to the sons of Israel and say to them, I am the Lord your God. 50 times we'll see this on to the end. You shall not do what is done in the land of Egypt where you lived. Now notice he's not being specific, he's being formal. He's just giving a general preamble like, nor are you to do what is done in the land of Canaan where I'm bringing you, you shall not walk in their statutes. You are to perform my judgments, keep my statutes, to live in accord with them. I am the Lord your God. Notice that reminder. So you shall keep my statutes and my judgment by which a man may live. If he does them, I am the Lord. Now notice, after that formal introduction about how you're to conduct yourself, then he gets into details. None of you shall approach any blood relative to uncover his nakedness. I am the Lord, and so forth. Now, as he proceeds through those regulations and has all kinds of case history, notice how we end out over in chapter 20, verse 22. Verse verse 22 of chapter 20, which closes the section of regulations for the people. The next section will be regulations for the priests, but now regulations for the people is being closed out. Okay, just to show the link, go back to verse 21, and he's being very specific, isn't he? If there is a man who takes his brother's wife, it is abhorrent. He has uncovered his brother naked, they shall be childless. Now, formal closing. You are therefore to keep all my statutes, now it gets general again, all my command, my ordinances, and do them, so that the land in which you are bringing you will not spew you out. Moreover, you shall not follow the customs of the nation which I drive you before you, for they did these things, and therefore I have abhorred them. Hence I have said to you, you are to possess their land, and I myself will give you to possess it, a land flowing with milk and honey. I am the Lord your God who has separated you from other people. And then down through verse 26, finally, thus you are a holy people to me, for I am the Lord am holy, and have set you apart as people to be mine. Okay, formal statement begins it. Then, coming into it, the first thing we have in chapter 18, inside of these two formal statements, is a section about sexual conduct. And that makes up all of chapter 18. And as you look through 18, you have, it's basically not couched as a sexual code. It's basically couched in this kind of idea. All of these things that they are not to do is what everybody else surrounding them was doing. That's the atmosphere for all of this. All of these things that you see in chapter 18, sexual perversions, these were all commonly practiced. So the idea is, remember, your walk is to be one of separation. Hey, here's the one all the Canaanites are doing. And I want you to understand that you are to be different than Canaanites, and consequently, you can document from these things, these activities in the Canaanite, the Hittite, people and so forth. So the idea is, look, Israel, you're in this cesspool. Now, in your sexual conduct, be different. And don't pick up on these things that are involved in chapter 18. Then notice chapter 19 becomes very general, and we just label that general admonitions. Almost everything in there is pretty general. Verse 3, you're to reverence your father and your mother. Verse 4, you're not to turn to idols, and so forth. You're not to swear falsely. You're not to steal. All of these things are general admonitions. And then in chapter 20, you have basically your penal sanctions. Now, here is a very basic, important thing. No pity for the individual is to be allowed to spoil the nation. That's a very, very important principle. I wish we practiced that today, is that God is going to say, look, I don't want to see you run off on some case of pity for this case over here, because that will contaminate the whole nation. In other words, we are not going to sacrifice the nation and its moral standards in the interest of one. And as you read through chapter 20, you can see very clearly there is a clear concept of capital punishment and so forth going throughout that section. All right, our next moves from regulations for the people and now regulations for the priest. And I've got here slide 26. I'm not sure why, but let's see if it's something. Okay, we're just back to the priest again. Regulations. And what we're going to have in these chapters is in chapter 21, there's something that this man is not to do. In chapter 22, there is something that these men are not to be. And in chapter 24, there is something that they are not to offer. So we've got what the priest is not to be, what the priest is not, first of all. Okay, let's click that off. Get rid of it. I'll just wipe it out. Okay, first of all, what the priest must not do. 21:1-15. And that's marked off in your notes by what the priest, what the priest, what the priest. Number one, what the priest must not do. Notice how beginning in 21, the emphasis is on his activities. Then the Lord said to Moses, speak to the priests, the sons of Aaron, and say to them, no one shall defile himself. That's what you're not supposed to do. Verse 4, he shall not defile himself. Verse 5, they shall not make any baldness on their heads. Verse 7, they shall not take a woman who is profaned by harlotry, and so forth. And down through verse 15, the emphasis is, these are practices that are forbidden to the priest. Then, beginning in 21:16 through 22:16, the emphasis is on certain things that a priest can't be. So now it's what the priest must not be. In other words, these are personal disqualifications from serving in the tabernacle. Beginning in verse 16, then the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, speak to Aaron, no man of your offspring throughout your generations who has a defect. That's something he can't be. That's not something he does. It's something he is. 4, verse 18, no one who has a defect shall approach a blind man, lame man, disfigured man, deformed man, and so forth. Down through the 22nd chapter, an emphasis on certain personal qualifications of things that a priest could not be. In saying that a blind man could not be a priest, God is not condemning blind people. He is simply saying that if the priest is to be symbolical of a representative before God, he ought to look right. And consequently, if he's blind, that is not a very good... How would you like for your high priest to be blind? That doesn't make a very good symbol, or a high priest that can't hear, that's deaf, or for that matter, in the context, a high priest that's ugly. And God says, we don't want priests that are ugly, blind, and deaf, and so forth. We want them to be symbolical of what they represent. So this is not a criticism of blind people or a condemnation of it. It's simply saying they physically don't fit the role. Okay, this is what he must not be. That is followed by very strict regulation on what he must not offer in his activity of priesthood, and that's 22:17 through 33. Just a flavor of it down to verse 33 of chapter 22:17. Now that would come next, wouldn't it? Okay. 22:17. Then the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, speak to Aaron, to his sons, and to all the sons of Israel, and say to them, when any man in the house of Israel, or aliens in Israel, who presents his offering, whether it is any of their votive or any of their freewill offerings, which they present to the Lord for a burnt offering, for you it must be accepted. It must be a male without defect from among the cattle, the sheep, or the goats. Whatever has a defect, you shall not offer. And then notice down at verse 22, those that are blind or fractured or maimed or have a running sore or eczema or scabs, you shall not offer to the Lord, nor make any of them offering before of the altar to the Lord. If, verse 23, an ox or a lamb which is overgrown or a stunted member, you may present it as a freewill offering, but an avowal will not be accepted, and so forth. So you have a limitation on just exactly what must be offered. Now, in this little section of three chapters, of 21, 22, and 23, there is a key word. They are to do all of these things, and if they don't do them, they are going to profane the tabernacle. And the word profane, in some form, occurs in these 21, 22, 23, these three chapters, 12 times. So that gives a stress that's going to come across. Don't profane my tabernacle, expressed in that particular word. All right, after regulations for the priest, we now have a set of regulations for the feast. Regulations for the feasts, 23 and 24. Now, let me give, if you're a King James user, a little technical note that is important. New American has handled it well. If you have King James, you've got in this chapter the word feast, and you've also got the word feasts, plural. Now, let me give a little information on that. The first word translated feast in the singular, which is chag in Hebrew. That is a proper, appropriate word meaning feast. The second word that is used in the context is the word mo'adim. And put it something like this, mo'adim in English. That does not mean feasts. It means a set season or an appointed season. So it should be set seasons. Christmas in our calendar would qualify. That's a set season. It's always November 20th. The other one. That's Halloween. That's Thanksgiving. Okay. Anything set season on the calendar. And therefore, if you're a King James user, whenever they have feast, singular, that's the right word. But whenever you see feasts, plural, in King James Version, that means set season. They change over and translate the Hebrew word a different way. So set seasons at which they had feasts is the idea. Now, what are they? All right. This is the chapter for which we can locate the feasts. First of all, there was the feast, three of them, the feast of Passover. And we're working on biblical content now. That's 23, 5 through 14. Now let me give you parenthetically something under that so you can recognize it elsewhere. It is also called Feast of Unleavened Bread. Feast of Unleavened Bread, Feast of Passover, same thing. Also called the Feast of Unleavened Bread, as in Exodus 23, 15, 34, 18, and other places too. So when you ever think of this one, Feast of Passover, it's Unleavened Bread. The second one, following context, is the Feast of Pentecost. And that is in 15 through 22. It is also called Feast of Weeks. It is also called Feast of First Fruits. So anytime you see first fruits, weeks, or Pentecost, that is the same feast. Then you have the blowing of trumpets. Blowing of trumpets, 23 to 25. Then you've got Yom Kippur, or Day of Atonement, which is chapter 23. And then you have the Feast of Tabernacles. And the Feast of Tabernacles is 23, 33 through 44. Also note, it's also called Feast of Ingathering. Such as in Exodus 33, 16. Notice, coming out of here, we've got three feasts then. Now, you probably see some, I don't know whether Scofield Reference Bible does or not, but we'll divide up into seven feasts. We haven't left anything out. They will subdivide some Passovers and so forth into different things, but basically that's what we've got. The Feast of Passover is going to be Unleavened Bread, Feast of Pentecost, or Weeks, or First Fruits, Trumpets, Day of Atonement, and the Feast of Tabernacle. In these three, if you're a Jewish male, 12 and over, wherever you lived, you had to go down to Jerusalem for these during the year. So these were your three annual pilgrimages down to, you went down for Passover, Pentecost, and Tabernacles in the Jewish calendar year. These three are important. The three are mentioned together in two places, in Exodus 33, 14, 14 through 16, it talks about the three national feasts, and also in Deuteronomy chapter 16, verse 16. Okay. Now, finally, we've got regulations about the land. Regulations about the land. Chapter 25 through chapter 27. In these three chapters, in 25 through 27, down to the end of the book of Leviticus, the land is mentioned some 30 times. You find a reference to the land 30 times. Now, I give numbers like 30. Don't come say, oh, I found 31 or I found 29. Okay, that's what I like to say about. It's always possible to miss one, but it's enough to see that that's a healthy thing that's being emphasized throughout the rest of the book of Leviticus. All right, we start off in the regulations for the land with your two periodic Sabbaths. One is in 25, 1 through 7, and it is, there is to be a Sabbath every seventh year. Every seventh year was to be a Sabbath year. And then in 25, 8 through 55, there was to be a Sabbath every 50th year. Now, what is the purpose for these Sabbaths? Why did God have these? Why did God say that every seventh year, let the land lie fallow? All right, I think we'll be able to see that if we'll look at 25:23. The first one simply said, every seventh year, let the land lie fallow. By the way, how many times did Israel do this? How many times did you go through the cycle? 6 years, then let the land set for a year, as God commands in chapter 25. Then 6 more years and let it set for a year. How many times did he do that? They never managed to do it once. Never got off the ground. And what's the significance of that? That is the time, according to Chronicles, that all of the Sabbaths they missed, you have to make up every last one of them. And why do you have in the Old Testament the 70-year captivity out of the land? Why did they have to sit for 70 years? Because you disobeyed God for that many. And Chronicles ties that directly in, is for every year you missed, you're going to make up. And consequently, the 70 years, the reason for the 70 years, is to make up for the Sabbath years that they had missed. Now, why would God want them to let the land lie fallow every seventh year? Why is it work 6 and rest 7? What would he want to do that for? All right, let's put down a few reasons for that. The first one is in verse 23. The land, moreover, shall not be sold permanently, for the land is mine, and you are but aliens and sojourners with me. Why did they need to obey God and let the land lie fallow the seventh year? To remind them of divine proprietorship. Was given to remind them of divine ownership. So every year that they would stop, they would be reminded that we're doing this because God is the owner, and the owner of this land said, don't you plant any crops this year. It would be acknowledging his sovereignty and his ownership of the land. They never did it, not even once. All right, a second idea. And this perhaps is more logical, but look down at chapter 25, verses 5 and 6. Verse 5. Your harvest's aftergrowth shall you not reap, and your grapes of untrimmed vines you shall not gather. The land shall have a sabbatical year. And all of you shall have the Sabbath products of the land for food, yourself and your male and female slaves, and your hired man and your foreign resident, those who live as aliens with you. Does it make any sense that this would be a check on greed? I think we can put that down as a fair reason. It was to serve as a check on greed. Remember, in this context, they God very sharply restricted greed in Israel by the fact that if a fellow Israelite, you loan him any money, what can't you do? You can't charge him interest. So that was forbidden in Israel. Look down at chapter 25, verse 35. Certainly shows in the context that greed is curbed by God. Now, in case a countryman of yours becomes poor and his means with regard to you falter, then you are to sustain him like a stranger or a sojourner. They may live with you. Do not take usurious interest from him, but revere your God, and your countrymen may live with you. You shall not give him your silver at interest, nor your food for gain. I am the Lord. Notice the reminder, I am the Lord your God. It's because of my name that you're to do this. So notice God did put a check on greed, and that was you're not to loan with any interest rate in Israel. All right? You know, it's interesting. I made a comment a while back on the 6 years you could work and the seventh to rest. Having that back in the book of Genesis. 6 days shall you work, and on the seventh you're to rest. And what do we always emphasize? On the seventh we're to rest, but what does God say about work? 4 days shall you work, and take the last three for rest. I'm not trying to say necessarily that the Bible is teaching a six-day work week, but, well, what is it saying? 6 days shall you work, and on the seventh, rest. We love to emphasize the rest. We very often do not give emphasis that what man is made for. 6 days we're to work, which means, does it not, that God is saying the majority of life is spelled work. And we ought to be alert to that today. There was a government publication, I lost it, it was really good, pointing out that the work ethic is completely lost today. And it was, I almost thought it was a conservative preacher. I was really amazed. It was a government document saying that you should not expect that people will be motivated that work is rewarding, that people should not be motivated that work is a right thing. This is not the atmosphere we live in today, and that's probably right, but it's not the biblical ethic. Again, 6 days shall you work. So, men, if you need to get in a Saturday, you got lots of ammunition to use on your wife. Why, you can't do the garage. Okay. Now, what else? What else would this land laying fallow for a year do? You think through logically? Wouldn't that land not being cultivated 1 year out of seven, wouldn't that create a people who had to trust God? So let's put down as a third purpose, to create a nation that trusted God. Notice you have that implied down in verse 20 of chapter 25. But if you say, what are we going to eat on the seventh year if we do not sow or gather in our crops? And God says, that's just what I'm trying to get across to you. I want to put you in a situation you're going to have to learn to trust me. Well, then, verse 21, I will so order my blessing for you in the sixth year that will bring forth the crop for 3 years. So notice God simply says, look, you've got these objections, you've got these what-if things. Now look, may I relax you on the what-if? If you're worried about that seventh year not having enough to eat, look, just concentrate on obedience with you. I said, let it rest on the seventh year. I'll take care of the food, okay? You obey, I'll make the provision. Very beautiful lesson that God had built in to, and you can imagine how all of the nervous Nellies would have reacted to this regulation. You know, this year we just barely made it. This is year two, and we just barely made it. We can't... Hey, if we didn't go out and work every day, we would never eat. Therefore, they could very easily begin to wring their hands about the fifth year when things were just, you know, it seems like everything we bring in is what we spend. You know what I mean? I mean, we make it and we spend it all, and at the end of the month, we hope the checkbook at least balances and doesn't bounce. And God says, well, we'll just make that real nice. And so consequently, if you were a nervous Nelly about the future and God's provision, you'd have a real hard time in Israel, because by the time you got to the end of that 6 years and you're coming up to the eighth month and the crop is just barely enough, you begin to chew some fingernails and say, well,
You know, we don't know what's going to happen. And so consequently, God says, concentrate on obedience. Do what I tell you to, and I'll take care of the consequences. And this is a very beautiful illustration of it. So that then, we've got the seventh year having three good advantages is let the land lie fallow, and remember, you're doing it because that's my land. I own it, therefore if I say don't plant corn on it, and you obey that, you're acknowledging that I'm the sovereign God over the land. And that was a good lesson. And therefore, we want to check on greed to be sure, leading, I take it into number three purpose, that you're going to have to trust God, and God built that right into the nations. All right, in chapter 26, basically you have conditions of blessing when they get in the land. Chapter 27 is going to be expressions of their love toward God. And now we're ready to take a look at Yom Kippur, chapter 17. Let's go back to it. That, in essence, is the content of Leviticus. Now let's go back to 17. This is the day in which the high priest went into the Holy of Holies. And we got a slide on that, so let's put it up there. Okay. This shows we're out in the outer court. This is the holy place. Then there'll be the veil, and then the Holy of Holies. And in the holy place, of course, the priest could operate. Notice the beautiful golden pillars coming into this thing. Badger skin on the outside. As we said this morning, the stress of the tabernacle is all the beauties on the inside. And we related to that to the fact that Christ became incarnate, and the Old Testament says in Isaiah 53, there's no beauty that we should desire Him. But the beauty of Christ was on the inside. And then, of course, Peter addressing Christian women saying, don't let your adorning be simply the outside, but you're to have inner beauty. And this is an interesting picture showing the rather unattractive badger skin on the outside, and then you're looking inside of the holy place with the beautiful golden pillars and so forth, and the priest would be occupied with, remember, the showbread, the light, and then the incense on in front of the veil. Noticed these are ordinary priests. There's a high priest. He's got on the ephod with the breastplate to make him stand out as different, and so forth. All right, let's hit the next one. Okay, this, again, is a general picture of Israel in the wilderness. If you ever get down around Masada, this sharp distinction between land coming up here and then suddenly these sharp cliffs, you can very vividly remember because the highway goes down this way. You can look over on the right, and it's just as though there's no incline to these hills. They just go straight up. At Masada, you're about 1,400 feet, almost sheer cliff, right straight down into the valley part. So that's a good scene for it. Notice how all the tribes, I don't know if you can see the tents back there. Notice all the tents surround this on all four sides. When we get into the book of Numbers, we'll point out how this tribe, their tents over here, this tribe with their tents over here, and over here. Of course, here is the pillar, the presence of God, and there goes the smoke up from the sacrifice. We approach God through the sacrifice, and there, of course, is the pillar. And all the city is around it. How's that for city life? What did you always see? Every time you get outside your tent, you're reminded God is present, and you're reminded God is satisfied through sacrifice. So day after day, you have that reminder. This is the only truly theocentric city or encampment ever known. And it was the way Israel was situated. With those tents and with the tabernacle so central, those lessons would be coming across every day. Can you imagine how you would be so linked in your mind, why do they kill animals? My sin. Sin, death, sin, death. You'd see it, you'd smell it, your clothes probably would be saturated with, you sin, you die. And the only approach to God is sacrifice. And that basically is the way the encampment was laid out. When we get to Numbers, we'll have a little diagram showing that. All right? That's better yet, isn't it? This has got them in their, well, the slide's in backwards, and I don't think you can see it anyway. But here's Asher, here's Issachar, And here's, I don't know, I can't read it. But all of these are their tribes, all neatly blocked off. And again, you can see how they're all sitting around the tabernacle with the two dominant lessons that you could see all through Israel. You would never miss the fact that God is present with that pillar of cloud. Okay? Okay, now we're coming down a top view again of that. Next. There would be some of your priestly activity. Or with the flame going up. It would be dramatic at night, wouldn't it? Or in the morning, with the morning sacrifice. You wouldn't look out and see the sunrise. You'd look up and see the flame go up as God was propitiated for the sins of the nation. Okay? Okay, now this is where we are right now. We're at the... Okay, can you go to the back side of the sanctuary? What this picture has done is that's the veil. It's pulled out the back wall. Okay? So we're looking in at the back. So that there's the veil, and behind him would be what? The holy place. And then on back toward the coming in. In other words, when we walk into it, you walk in from back there, and for the sake of seeing what goes on in there, this pulls off the back of the tabernacle so we can see in. Okay, and this is the Day of Atonement. The priest comes in, and we'll be looking in just a moment at what he does and what occurs here at the presence of God. One time, under very strict condition, per year, the high priest gets into the presence of God. All right, let's take a look at that. That's Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement. And that's what happened on that particular day. All right, let's go back now to the text. And the first thing we want to look at is what was the purpose of Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement? And the first thing I would put down as far as purpose for this day is to remind Israel that the only holy thing, the only perfect thing in the tabernacle is God Himself. The purpose is to remind Israel that the only holy, perfect being in the whole priestly tabernacle setup is God Himself. To remind Israel that the only perfect being in the tabernacle is God. Now we can derive that from the fact that on the Day of Atonement, the people had to be purified, the priests had to be, the high priest had to be, and even the furniture had to be. And what's that saying? There is nothing that savors of perfection and holiness except God Himself. And this day proved it. Every priest gets cleansed, the high priest gets cleansed, and every piece of furniture in the tabernacle is going to get cleansed. A second purpose would be to remind the nation that her standing with God needed renewal. To remind the nation that her standing with God needed renewal. Every year, or we might add to that, they're reminded every year that no sacrifice that we see in this whole system really deals with sin. No sacrifice that we see really deals with sin. Now that's going to be the logic of the book of Hebrews. If it did, how come you have to do it all over again? If there was a once for all adequate sacrifice for sin, how come every year, and the writer of Hebrews is going to treat the Day of Atonement as a reminder that, look, the sacrifice hasn't come yet. Because what do we have to look forward to? Another Day of Atonement. And after that, what do we look forward to? Another Day of Atonement. No sacrifice really deals with sin yet, and they were yearly reminded of that idea. Okay. Third, the Day of Atonement underscores the Old Testament doctrine of assurance. I'm going to show you how that works in just a moment. Underscores the Old Testament doctrine of assurance. Okay, now on this day, let's take a look very quickly at what the priest did. First of all, what he did for himself. If you're a high priest on Yom Kippur, the Day of Atonement, the first thing you would do would be to bathe, put on the priestly garments, except for the ephod. The ephod was the part that had the children of Israel had the breastplate on it. Now, why do you suppose that the priest, to start out the Day of Atonement, wouldn't have the ephod on? Because to start the Day of Atonement, the priest wasn't really representing anybody. He needed to get clean himself. And so the emphasis is, you just bathe, put on your priestly garments, and the first issue is you. We've got to get you cleaned up, because even though you're high priest, the only perfect thing around the tabernacle is God, and we'll start right up at the top of the priest and get him cleaned up first. So he would put on the priestly garments minus the ephod. He would take a bull, slay it, and he would take the blood plus coals from the altar. That's where the sacrifice was made. And some incense, and he went within the veil. So, Lee, give us a picture again. I don't know whether the elements are there. Okay, he would have now to put on the mercy seat. He's come within the veil. Notice his ephod is gone. He is. We're getting the man clean. He's not, per se, at this point, representing the nation, though there is an element of that there. He doesn't have his ephod on. This incense here would be from the altar at the front. Only way to approach God is via the sacrifice of the altar. It would be motivated and lit by that fire, the incense. And the incense, as it's described, literally filled this place in here. Just saturated. Incense, inevitably, in Old Testament and New Testament, is prayer and worship. So he came in and saturated the presence of God with worship. And where did he get the fire? He got the fire from the altar. So the idea is, he's coming in, and I am offering you praise and worship on the basis of the sacrifice, and then he would take the blood of the bull and put it right here on the mercy seat. A priest never entered the Holy of Holies without blood. Never, 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 never. So he went in with three things. The blood to go on the altar, the fire, little bucket of fire of coals from the altar, and the incense, and he literally filled the place, the presence of God, with worship and praise, and that was the first thing that he did for himself. Then, and you can cut it off now, then he did something for the people. At that point, he would take a goat, and then he would take the blood of the goat, and he would place it on the mercy seat for the people. But for himself, now we cleanse the people. Then, here is our Old Testament doctrine of assurance on the Day of Atonement, and it's found in 16:21-22. The scapegoat, Azazel. Notice in 16:21, he has made atonement in the preceding part, and sin is forgiven. Now, after the atonement is made, notice what he does. It says, verse 20, when he finishes atoning for the holy place and for the tent of meeting and the altar, he shall offer the live goat. So notice we've cleansed everything now. He got cleansed, the furniture got cleansed, the people got cleansed, and the priest got cleansed. Then Aaron shall lay both of his hands on the head of the live goat and confess over it all the iniquities of the sons of Israel. Now, this is after atonement. What's he doing this for? And all of their transgressions in regard to all their sins, and he shall lay them on the head of the goat and send it away into the wilderness by the hand of the man who stands in readiness. And the goat shall bear on itself all their iniquities to a solitary land, and he shall release the goat into the wilderness. I take it the lesson is this. After the blood atonement was made, God wanted to assure Israel, you will never face your sins again. The Old Testament doctrine of assurance. So the idea is, sin is atoned for, and I want you to have a very vivid lesson. Your sin is confessed on the head of this animal, and wouldn't it be a thrill in Israel to watch as the scapegoat and whoever was going to take the scapegoat went down through the houses and finally disappeared out of sight, never to see that goat again. And what was on that goat? Your sins. And God is saying, I have atoned at the altar, and I want you to know what that means. That means you will never again face your sins. The Old Testament doctrine of assurance. All right, very quickly, how Hebrews sees Leviticus. Okay, let's go over to Hebrews chapter 7, and basically I want to point out that the book of Hebrews builds so much on the tabernacle. Number one, Christ as priest is superior to all of your priests in the Old Testament. That's one of the first thoughts that the book of Hebrews brings out. Christ as priest is superior. Chapter 7, verse 23 through 25. 7:23. And the former priests, looking back to the Old Testament, on the one hand, existed in greater numbers. We looked at these pictures, and you had lots of priests, didn't you? This is Hebrews 7:23. They existed in greater numbers because they were prevented by death from continuing. In other words, here's a priest that carries on a wonderful ministry on behalf of the people, and he died. And the author of Hebrews says, let's latch on to that. And verse 24, but he, on the other hand, because he abides forever, holds his priesthood permanently. Hence also, he is able to save forever. He is eternal in his priesthood, therefore he can give us an eternal salvation to all those who draw near to God through him, since he always lives to make intercession for them. So, Christ as priest is superior because he lives forever. Because he is eternal. If you want the information, Aaron to Eleazar, Numbers 20, verse 28, and Aaron died and couldn't function as high priest anymore, Eleazar takes up. Next, Eleazar to Phinehas, P-H-I-N-E-A-S, Joshua 24, 33, and Eleazar died. Now, according to Josephus, the Jewish historian, up till 70 A.D., there were 83 more. So we've gone from, in the Old Testament, Aaron, Eleazar, to Phinehas, whose high priest ministry was terminated by death. And then according to Josephus, you've got 83 from on to that point. Can you get back to the high priest again in there? Okay, we just got it. That's fine. There you go. Well, if you get back to high priest, Grace. Looking at this. There he is. Really, when you look at it, it's a beautiful picture, isn't it? Of our mediator, the one that takes into the presence of God. Can you imagine a tremendous responsibility in Israel to be holy, representing this whole nation before God? And this man dies, the next one takes over, the next one takes over, and therefore the lesson of their transiency as over against his eternal high priesthood. But there's something else we ought to begin to relate to. When Christ was placed on trial and condemned to death, by whom? The high priest in Israel. So as we come down from this man Aaron, you have a continually depraved priesthood. So that brings in another superiority, going back to Hebrews. He is superior as priest because he didn't sin. He was sinless. Hebrews 7, verse 26. For it is fitting, or it was fitting, that we should have such a high priest, holy, innocent, undefiled, separated from sinners, and exalted above the heavens. Is that what we've been describing on the Day of Atonement? The old Aaron, high priest, has got to atone for Aaron, got to bring in the blood, because he also is a sinner. And our high priest is better because he's different. Who, verse 27, does not need daily, like those high priests, to offer up sacrifices, first for his own sins and then for the sins of the people, but this he did once for all when he offered himself. So notice the argument that the book of Hebrews is building, assuming we understand the priesthood in the Old Testament. Can you see how much easier, by the way, Hebrews is to understand when we have this a little foundation back in the book of Leviticus? Okay, second. Think about the priesthood in Israel. What covenant was it based on? They go down to Sinai, don't they? And at Sinai, they get the law. And part of the law was the book of Leviticus. So the Levitical priesthood operated under the law. Do you know anything about the law for what it can do for man? We've been through it in Romans. Can the law save? The law is weak in what respect? It depends on man. So, the second is Christ is superior because his priesthood is not based on the law. Christ's priesthood was not based on the law. And that is noted in chapter 7, verse 6. No, it's not. Well, someone locate it? Where it points out it's based on better... It's over here on the right Bible, but I'm trying to use this new funny one. What's that? 7-11? 7-11? Oh, okay, that's the one I had in mind. That's good. It says now, verse 11, if perfection was through the Levitical priesthood, for on the basis of if the people received the law, then what need was there for a further one? But that still isn't it. I'm looking at the one that talks about a better covenant. 22, there it is. So much more, 7:22, also Jesus, has become the guarantee of a better covenant. And notice, by the way, instead of being based on the law, what is his priesthood based on? Verse 21. For they indeed became priests without an oath, and he with an oath through the one who said to him, Jehovah speaks, the Lord has sworn and will not change his mind, thou art a priest forever. He was not because of the law, his was based on decree. That a little more solid? It's based on the eternal decree of God. Third, in 10:1 of Hebrews, we're told how we ought to take the Levitical priesthood and the tabernacle and so forth. It says, for the law, since it has only a shadow of good things. The word shadow, skia, is sketch. So, the law, and what we're studying in the worship system, is shadow Christology. It is shadow Christology. Fourth, Old Testament sacrifices were repeated, therefore weak. Old Testament sacrifices were repeated, therefore weak. Now Hebrews builds on that in chapter 10, I hope. 10:1. For the law, since it has only a shadow of good things to come and not the very form of things, can never by the same sacrifices year by year, which they offer continually, make perfect those that draw near. Otherwise, they would not have ceased to be offered, because the worshipers, being once cleansed, would no longer have consciousness of sin, and so forth. And notice how heavily he goes into the tabernacle in the following context. Therefore, what was the value of these? The Old Testament sacrifices had illustrative power only. They had illustrative power only. That's clear. Look at 10:4. 10:4 says, it is impossible for the blood of bulls and goats to take away sins. They didn't have that power, but they could illustrate. And then down in 11 and 12, the same idea. Every priest stands daily ministering and offering time after time the same sacrifices, which can never take away sins. But he, having offered one sacrifice for sins for all time, sat down on the right hand of God. So as beautiful as the illustrations are that we've seen today in the sacrifice and the system of Israel, we need to keep in mind that's all nice pictures, beautiful lessons, rich spiritual truth, but thank God our priest is alive. He's alive forever. His sacrifice is perfect. It will never be made again, and he ever lives to make intercession for us. So we have a thrill beyond the Levitical priesthood, which is the high priesthood of Christ, developed in the book of Hebrews as he's a high priest after the order of Melchizedek, an entirely different priesthood line. Ken. basically, offerings are substituted for good works. There is no blood in Israel today. There's no blood in Judaism. Blood atonement, no longer. That's out. And basically, it is a substitution of good works. Good works are the altar today. Good works and prayers and what have you. Okay, next week, where are we? We'll be, we're ready to pack up the tents, aren't we? Well, we do need to hear a sermon. We do need to hear Deuteronomy. And that's a good book. So we'll probably, what we'll be doing is we'll get our last sermon as we're ready to go in and take that land now. And that will be the sermon given in the book of Deuteronomy by Moses to the people. We'll see some principles in that. And from that point, we'll be ready to do some fighting to get into the land. Father, we're thankful today for your truth. We pray that, like Israel, we will hear it in order to obey it. May we recognize the tremendous principles of the Old Testament and realize that all of this is foundational, that the author of Hebrews, when he wants to talk about the perfection of Christ, utilizes the Old Testament. And what a pitiful thing for us to be ignorant of his illustrative material and thus miss the richness of the book of Hebrews. And therefore, may we be well equipped in the Old Testament in order to understand further revelation in your word. For we ask this in Christ's name. Amen. Value of these. The Old Testament sacrifices had illustrative power only. They had illustrative power only. That's clear. Look at 10:4. 10:4 says it is impossible for the blood of bulls and goats to take away sins.